record on this computer. Boom. Hello, gentle internet folks and people who are here now. It is Wednesday, August 9th, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync. Looks like we have Benoit, Gordon, Joe, Theo, and Sylvan today. Like, so far, no new folks, but you never know. That was great last week when we had, was it Tom from, who was out from outside of Boston, was it? I think. I don't remember. Anyway, shall we start with some RFCs? How about RFC 87, serialized signature method. I believe this has been, it's been 7 days. We've had no additional comments. I think this is good for voting. Does anybody disagree?
I just want to confirm that Benoit, you have a plan for this, right?
the details are still to be defined, but the general idea should work.
Okay. Sounds good.
Awesome.
This, coincidentally, when you're looking at this, I don't know, can you see the fact that it's referenced from our private repo?
No, because your repo is private, so unless you have access to the repo that references it, you don't see the references.
That's I figured that, but I was just curious. So anyway, when we open it up, that will appear on it. All right, okay. I'm going to merge this. Theo, can you do? Oh, right. Sorry, we're all in favor of this, right?
Yep.
We've all discussed it before.
Yeah, I think
everyone except Joe, as usual, who always votes against his own RFCs.
Okay, boom.
I'm really self-deprecating.
It's down. If you could put that in the other repo, Theo, and I'm going to add it to the last week in Pony.
Okay.
I got my placeholder there for it until it's actually. Over and updated. Okay, next is 98. That has also been in final comment for a week. Looks like we had some stuff about Paul kicking out a different RFC for some stuff. I think this is good for a vote. Yes, number 98.
I like.
Yeah, I'm in favor.
So am I.
Okay.
That's good to me.
All right. Everybody's in favor. Boom. So
we get the truck noise to punctuate it.
First accepted RFC.
I actually almost thought that was a sound effect to signal success of merging the RFC.
No. Although that would be cool. Okay.
That would be really cool, actually.
We need to get a horn thing for that. Okay, I'm adding that to the last week in Pony. This is nice. Last week in Ponies have gotten more interesting over the last 3 months or so. More stuff. Good, although it takes me longer. I have to get up earlier on Saturday morning to write it up. The one time that I left it till Sunday to do, I totally forgot, and then it was Sunday night before I did it. So. All right, and just so you're aware, Sylvan, because I am also your reminder, there is a new RFC opened 101.
I was just reading 101.
And for everybody else as well, there is a new RFC that was opened 101. And when did you open that? Oh, you opened it, and I missed that, and I didn't add it to last week in Pony. So that's good. If anybody has any comments on it, feel free to go to there and put stuff on it. But shall we move? Oh, that's Wallaroo stuff. Not so Pony C. Do we have any? Oops, I went to the sentence fork of Pony C, which is, oh, it's gonna hurt when we have to upgrade. Thanks for that explicit partials thing there, Joe. That's gonna make my life hard.
Makes your life hard at first and easy later.
That's right.
It's both. It's going to make my life much better in the long run, but in the short term of when we have to get from 09, our 09 fork to wherever we're at, it's going to be painful.
Hopefully the script should just take care of it for you.
Hopefully, we'll see. All right, we have a couple PRs here. We have, let's start with 2143. This is Benoit's. It touches 19 files. Sylvan, you were requested by Benoit as a reviewer. It's CodeGen, use distinct memory representation types.
Sorry, just a second here. I was going over RFC 101. PR
2143. It feels like just like a couple weeks ago we were in the 1900s and I was 1800s and I was making stupid jokes.
Now we live in the future.
This is past the end of days now.
Oh damn it! That's very inconvenient. Wow. Wait. Did LLVM finally fix I1? When did I1 get fixed?
Which bug are you talking about?
The fact that LLVM I1, we can now use LLVM I1s for bools in some places as a value type.
I'm not sure since Clang still uses I8 for booleans in memory. So this PR changes bool to only use I1 in as a value type.
I see. So like when you have a constant or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. Oh. So where are we hoisting it back to an I8 when we need to? I see. There's a couple of places where there's a genassign cast. I see.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah, that's nice. And so it gets wrapped up in genassign casts, and that makes it relatively simple. Cool. I realize I'm looking at a 19-file commit and calling this relatively simple, but believe it or not, it is. Okay. So there's a little bit of interesting stuff in make signature, isn't there? That's fine.
This is needed because we generated the function types for behaviors, and we directly used that type for the structure type of the message, and now we can do that because the function. A behavior taking a boolean will take an I1, but the message type must
take an I8. Yeah, it has to. Yep. Okay. So there's a little bit of fiddly-biddly there, but that's not very fiddly in this grand scheme of things. Okay. And then... yeah, and then the make prototype stuff is sort of the mirror image of that, sort of, kind of. And same with the dispatch stuff. And the genassign casts and placed in more places like ident and match and operator. I'm going to just not even look at GenPrim because I'm just going to assume it's a mess, but for good reasons. Yeah, this looks good. All right. As far as I'm concerned, we can merge that. Anyone else have any comments on it? Sorry, I should probably clarify what the heck this thing is. So LLVM has a intermediate representation type, an IR type called I1. Which is intended to be able to express a Boolean as a one-bit integer. Technically a one-bit signed integer, but since that's a meaningless concept, it's just a one-bit integer. Unfortunately, the truth of the way LLVM handles I1 as a memory representation is that it pretty much doesn't. It's just incredibly buggy. And that's unfortunate, but there you go. And so Pony, like all the other compilers that use LLVM as a backend, including Clang, most importantly, but everyone else as well, has been using an I8 as the representation of a bool in every case. And what this change does is it says, as long as you're not using it as an in-memory representation, as long as it's an IR representation rather than a memory representation, you can use an I1, and that can be quite good for the way LLVM can optimize certain things. And then what we do is when we have an I1 and we want to do a memory assignment, that's when we hoist it to an I8 and use 8 bits to represent our 1-bit value. Anyway, it's a good change.
Nice. I merged that.
Yay.
So we got some issues. The other PR we had was a simple one to switch, to use a specific version of Pony Stable for when we do when we release stuff and everything, when we get stuff. Cool. We're doing the build, and Joe had already approved that.
Cool.
By the way, speaking of Pony Stable, we've been working on the Pony Stable repo with Gordon's help. I got CI being done for Stable for both OS X, Linux, and Windows. The Windows part, because in case anybody missed it, Gordon got Stable working on Windows, and then there was a bug fix that somebody came in to correct one minor problem with that. So Stable now works across all of our supported platforms.
Wow, nice one.
Yay.
So that's awesome. And we're working through that, which reminds me real quick, before we go on to issues, In the Pony Stable repo, Sylvan, you're the only one who needs to sign off on this at this point. Uh-oh. If you could look at the PR where there needs to be a license that's in here, right? So I put together a license where basically it's just, are you okay with the Pony developers being what's on it for the copyright? Otherwise, it's just two-clause BSD. Okay.
Yep. That's great. And in fact, we should change the one for the Pony compiler to be the same.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. Considering right now the entity holding the copyright there is
does not exist
anymore. So.
Yes.
So what we can do is we can leave the 2014 to 2015 in, right? Because it's no good removing stuff and pretending things didn't happen. But mm-hmm. we can slap in a 2016, 2017, the Pony developers.
Yep, yeah, that makes sense.
If we had forced it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
All right, boom. So we got a license. So yeah, I've been working on the Stable one before we do that. It's something, you know, there's an open issue in the Pony Stable one for what kind of automated tests could we have for this. So if people want to chime in on that issue, that would be great. Also one that I'm probably, Gordon, going to need your help with is getting pre-built binaries of Stable available in Bintray so that people would be able to use, if we're going to be saying, hey, you should use this tool, then having it available so that you can, you know, install it in the same way that you could install pre-built Pony or whatever seems to make sense. Then we could also not have to build Pony Stable when we're using it for our own projects as well. We can just download the latest dependency. So
yeah, I can do that for Windows.
Cool. I'm probably not going to have a chance to do it for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks unless I take a break from learning French and decide to do a pony thing instead. But yeah. Okay. So issues, back to the Pony C repo. We have unhelpful error about type parameter viewpoint 2132, which was opened by Theo.
I think I commented on this one.
Nope, no comment.
Ah, sorry. Oh no, this is not the one I was thinking of. Okay. I think the weird thing going on here probably has to do with the fact that object literals and lambdas are they're kept frozen through all the compiler passes until you get to the expression pass, and then you unfreeze them and catch them up. I think that might be related to this issue.
What?
Okay, I think what's going on here is that the X is getting assigned to an X. It's getting assigned to a field within the object, right? Implicitly, because it's a capture. And it's supposed
to be back and claiming that XS is the source. Because look where it's pointing.
Yeah. I'm sure, you know, when you're generating the AST for the field, it's pointing back to the original place that it came from. It should be pointing to X, right? Not XS.
Not only that, it's pointing to the XS in the damn signature, which is...
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the...
I think Theo's description of this as unhelpful is generous.
So what you're getting at is it needs to be pointing to readseek, right? Not the colon?
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't even understand why it's pointing up there, because then it leads the programmer to believe, I think, personally, that it'll be pointing at a viewpoint type. But it's not a viewpoint type.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying I think what's going on is that, right, so X is being assigned to XS.
You get a T bang out of that.
Yeah, and then it's getting captured as a field, and because you're reading it from fun instead of fun ref, it's going to be this
t-bang.
Right.
Which won't look like a box T, right? That's fine, but that's the real complaint should be that this t-bang is not a subtype of box T. I suspect.
Yeah, it's got something to do, there's probably something a little bit wonky with how the implicit captures are working.
Also, that's very interesting. About how, yeah, you're absolutely right. And then it's pointing at the wrong node. And if we're pointing at the right AST node, it might be a little clearer.
Well, I can explain why it's pointing at the colon. There's actually a fix that I filed since then that fixes that.
Oh, okay. I was thinking more, why is it even pointing at that node as opposed to pointing at the X?
Yeah.
Why is it pointing at the definition of XS?
And it's, or at T.
Indeed. Basically, that's a good one. And it works because T bang is a subtype of box T. Is why that works. And then box T is a subtype of box T. Oh, that's interesting. But then this T bang would also be a subtype. I wonder if actually there's a little bit of subtype, not quite getting the subtypes right there. Oh, not sure. Okay, that certainly bears investigation.
Can you drop some kind of summary?
I can make some random comments.
That's better. That's better than nothing. Yes. And while you were doing that, let's move on to 2133. If you look at 2133, there's code which is in the tutorial for control structures for repeat, for what you can do with repeat. And it doesn't compile. And I haven't used repeat often enough to know whether the tutorial is incorrect or whether there's a code that should compile that doesn't.
Yeah, it's a question of whether the until clause can reference a variable from the repeat.
From inside the repeat block, which the tutorial says it can.
Tutorial will be wrong.
Tutorial will be wrong. Okay, so.
Well,
the tutorial is wrong for right now. The question is, was it right at some point and it shouldn't be right again?
Indeed.
When somebody brought this up on IRC and I was like, really? And then they pointed me to the tutorial. It's like, wow, okay. Well, that would be interesting if you could do that. And I would be very confused that that
was. So there's a scope for a repeat, but the repeat body is a sequence. So new things inside the repeat body, that's not a raw seek. That's a seek. And generally speaking, well,
yeah, it's not a containing scope. It's it's another scope that's contained in the same parent, but it's not declaring a containing scope. So I don't even think this is useful, honestly. Like, you could just use break.
Yeah. The tutorial is actually wrong for this one, but boy, the way in which scopes are defined for a repeat block is interesting.
Really, that bad?
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with it, right?
So it should be sort of, roughly speaking, the same as a while loop. So a while loop is totally fine. It's got an enclosing scope. The condition is a raw sequence. So it's a sequence, but things defined in the condition leak into the enclosing scope such that they can be referenced in the sequence for the body and the sequence for the else clause. That sort of makes sense, right? So things defined in the body can't be seen in the else clause and vice versa, but both of them can see things in the condition. Now, the repeat follows the same pattern. There's an enclosing scope, and there is a scope for the body, and there is a scope for the else clause, and it's a raw sequence for the condition expression. But this leads to something interesting, which is that the body cannot see things defined in the condition because the things defined in the condition appear after the body in program order. But the else clause can, because the else clause appears after the condition expression in program order.
I'm trying to come up with a non-cursing way to describe that.
Interesting is the word you're looking for.
It's interesting. That's a very interesting thing that happened there.
The thing about this is this actually makes perfect sense in terms of defining the most possible visibility for a new declaration, right? Basically for a new local variable. It does. It correctly defines the most possible visibility. And I don't think there's any particular reason that we should cut off the else clause from being able to see things declared in the condition expression. It's sort of fine. But certainly the tutorial is wrong that the condition block can't see anything that's defined in the body. And for good reason, because the body might not have defined everything in that sequence by the time it exits that sequence. And for example, could call continue, and that would jump immediately to the until, and you could have a variable that was declared after the continue, and then things would get rather complex.
Okay, that's a great explanation.
Definitely is. Okay, so I added a, an issue to the tutorial for that and closed that one. So
cool.
Up to date on that. So the next thing we have before we continue on with the, if we continue on with the issues, will take a little bit. So we're at a couple minutes before four. Does anybody have anything that they would like to raise? I'm going to take that as a no. And we can carry on then. So Paul is not around, but let's take a look. He opened one, 2144. Bad location reported for impossible pattern with type alias. Let's look like Joe, you tagged it with needs investigation. Is there anything to go over for this, or we good so far on this?
I think there's not a lot to go over. Yeah, I think the issue is that the error comes after the as gets expanded to a match.
Wow.
Indeed. Yeah. So strangely, that error makes perfect sense if you happen to understand the desugaring logic inside the compiler. Unfortunately for programmers, that is not cool.
Oh my God, that's going to be the perfect segue to the next one. Oh my God, so perfect. Yeah.
It makes perfect sense.
I'll add a comment that it's because it happens after the as is desugared to a match, so we have to figure out what makes more sense.
Yeah.
So, the next one is 2145. Sylvan, do you remember way back in the beginning when I first started working on Pony stuff and I was working on the DocGen?
Yeah.
And we had a long conversation about how the stuff that by the time we get to the DocGen pass, the stuff that's in there has been expanded out into an internal form, which is not necessarily something that you can plug into the compiler and have work.
Yep.
But on the other hand, we needed that because otherwise we wouldn't know all the types and everything for everything before then.
Indeed.
Okay, so 2145 should seem really familiar to you. Because Matthias and I had a fairly long conversation about this on IRC the other day because he tried to take some code that was in the standard lib and put it into something and it wouldn't compile, which is definitely not a good thing. Yes.
Yeah, so as I suggested here, although Paul corrected me, thankfully, I suggested here that basically, I think we just need to make kind of a special case in the type printing logic for this, so that when we're printing a type param reference, we don't print the cap. And I was saying that we should do it only if we're not in a constraint, but Paul pointed out that, you know, in a constraint, it's not a type param reference, it's just a type param.
But something that I think that Matthias and I did talk about is that it would be nice for when we're generating documentation for stuff, to have the original textual form for it, for the actual output and display, while still having the information that was collected for it. And I know we had originally punted that to when we would have Pony and Pony, but seeing how we just had a long conversation about it again on IRC, I thought I would bring it up and see if anybody had any thoughts on that in general. Again, seeing how it's been, 15 months since the last time we talked about this?
I think we can use the original source code, since every token has a link to its position in the source code. So what we could do is generate the documentation from the bounds of the first token in the type and the last token in the type, and that should point to exactly where the type is defined in the source code.
So I'm not sure that works when it comes to finding the end bound. And this is something that I kind of talked about briefly in my comment, was that as you mentioned, the token points to the start of the start of where it is in the source code, but I don't think we're capturing at all. Like, for example, in this case, what we want is from the opening square brace to the closing square brace, for example. I don't think we're capturing that closing square brace in a token at all. I think it's just being discarded by the parser, because what we're using for error reporting is just the start of things, and the start of that thing is just the opening square brace. We're not tracking the entire, like, the source end.
Yeah, so could we use the start of the next token that's not part of the type?
We could if we found it.
You might be able to if you like got rid of any white space in between. But I mean, I'm thinking that the best bet is just to make sure that the type printing logic is printing correct, valid pony code, which I think can be done with fairly simple special case. In this case.
Yeah, and for this one. So this is a bug.
Right. I mean, like, I think in general, like, we should be able to, if given an AST, we should be able to print it to valid pony source code. I think that's a, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not necessarily easy, but it's something that we should be capable of doing within the scope of pony safe.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that issue of we've desugared to the point where we can't recover something that resembles the original source code. But I think this particular issue, that's not that should be fixable. But I think that's why Sean was bringing up the desugaring stuff, is that there are cases where, well, we've desugared your as to a match, and now tricky to put that back.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something that I guess I'll try to keep in mind for Pony CC, is to be tracking the end locations correctly the whole way down, which is going to require some extra work. But I don't know that it's reasonable to retrofit Pony C to do that right now. But maybe it is.
The original conclusion we came to was that it wasn't reasonable. But
I think there's two different things. I think you're thinking about preserving the original AST, uh-huh. And I think.
Right. Just tracking where it was in the original.
Yeah,
I'm talking about every time you do sugar or like every time you build an AST node, you don't have to, you're not just worried about the start location, but also the ending location that you want to track from.
Right.
Which is something I can do in Pony CC, since it's still in the early stages of that, but it seems like a big effort to retrofit Pony CC to that.
Yeah.
And if the goal is to move DocGen to Pony CC, then or like a PonyCC based tool, then maybe that's the answer for this. Although, I mean, for this specific case, we could do that special case that I mentioned. Because, I mean, people also want to be able to build, like, Pony formatting tools, right? Like, we had a discussion at IRC about building a Pony formatting tool using PonyCC, and one of the things that I get hung up on is what I don't like is, like, the straight-up, like, take an AST and just, like, generate a source from only the information in that AST because it can discard style choices that the programmer made. So you want to take into account the original source that they wrote, and then just change the parts that your configuration tells you to change. And that's how I would prefer a formatting tool to work.
Right. In which case the tracking ends is a much nicer way to do it. Yeah. I like that.
Whereas Sean just wants it to smush it all. But
well, I mean, that's easier to solve, right? Like I can make sure we solve both.
five years ago, I hated all formatting tools. Now I'm just like, no, smush it all.
Smush.
Actually, I don't know. I'm starting to come around on it. Like, I think there might be something like related to like human psychology that is relevant here because, you know, I've been having a chat with some coworkers about it, and you know, I think some people are a little bit like, for whatever reason, their psychology is more tuned where they can step into a code base, look around, and just kind of mimic the style fairly easily. And in some people, that's much harder, you know, who are otherwise very, like, you know, intelligent, capable, competent people. I had sort of been looking at it like that's something that everyone should be able to do, but maybe there's something in human psychology where that's not really true and not really something that's reasonable to be expected of everyone.
I'm one of those people who's very good at stepping in and like, following whatever the style is, but you know, it's gotten to the point with me now where I'm just like, you know, I just want to be able to tell people who are working on a project, run this tool over your thing and it'll format it the way it should be, and then we never have to ask you to reformat something or hey you missed this in the style guide, blah blah blah, etc. It's for me at this point, it's just like I just want to lower the barrier to entry. And if it makes a few lines of source code everywhere look not as good as I would do it by hand, okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not quite at that point, but I am at the point where I think that, you know, it's not necessarily reasonable to ask everyone to jump in mimic style, and that you know, for some basic stuff, like, you can have rules that change those things and not the other things that are sort of more, as I see it, up to human, you know, human stylistic choices, like as creative individuals.
And all right, we got one more issue. Unhandled error message reports error in try block. And this is 2146, opened by Paul 18 hours ago. So, let's see.
Yeah, I'm guessing it has to do with how.
This is quite funny. It's the way it's searching for errors. So it's saying these are all the places where errors can be raised. What's the problem? But of course, it should only be reporting the second one because the first one isn't an unhandled error. It's correctly saying an error can be raised here. It's just that by linking that to the other error message, it's highly misleading.
So do we have any idea where it might be, or just...
I do, yeah.
I just dropped a comment and I said, if someone wants to look at this, the relevant code's in the verify pass.
Okay, so bug needs investigation. It's probably, what, a medium or an easy?
That's actually going to be an easy.
It's going to be an easy, okay. And priority medium. Boom. All right, that's the last one. Yeah, I think that's it for right now. Unless anybody's got anything. And since we started, Tom Johnson is back. So hi, Tom, back for your second week. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Just lurking again.
Good. Yep. Quite all right.
It's a good way to learn.
Excellent. Indeed. All right. So, has anybody got anything before we call this one and head off?
I might just give a little semi summary of what I've been thinking about of the ISO to val garbage collection problem.
That would be dope.
Okay, cool. And if anyone gets bored as hell by this, really, that's cool. You can log off. I understand. So I don't know if people are familiar with the fact that there is a memory leak in the garbage collector when an actor, yeah, when you have a chain of actors that deal with something isolated, and then another actor.
By the way, this is issue 837 is what it's opened under.
Awesome, thank you. Finally, some actor later in the chain then receives this object graph as immutable, or sends it as immutable, I should say, to some other actor who will then receive it as immutable. And what happens is it quite correctly goes and makes sure that there's reference count available for these things before then sending it on, and that. That's good, except that what it turns out is some percentage of the object graph, which is to say all previously isolated things that had become immutable that were not the top-level object, will now leak because there will be an excess reference count of one that will never be collected. I'd been thinking about this a lot as the invariant was that we wanted to make sure that each actor traced only its immutable objects during tracing. And in order to enforce that, I was coming up with very complex schemes to try and make sure that an object remained protected, but the reference count was still accounted for. And it was leading to schemes where, well, first of all, I wrote two different implementations which still leaked, well, one that still leaked memory and one that prematurely collected objects, which is even worse. And now I think that the invariant is actually something different, and that there are times when we do want to go ahead and trace things that we know are immutable, even though they're owned by other actors, because it should drastically simplify the way that we handle protection. So protection, I mean that if we talk about something as being reachable from an actor, meaning there is some path to it, and it's in its remembered set, so these are foreign objects, and reachable star, meaning there's some path to it, but it's not in its remembered set. In other words, it got an immutable and it didn't trace through that, so it doesn't really know that it's been passed this object. It's just reachable from some immutable object that it's been passed. That we want to make sure for every reachable star object, there is something out there that's stopping that object from getting garbage collected, since the current actor does not hold a reference count for it. And the simplest way to do that is to say that the owner of that top-level object is still responsible for tracing that top-level object all the way down, even though it's encountering things that it doesn't own. And that establishes the protection invariant. And so what I'm working on right now is making sure that while that cuts down on message passing a lot, and it looks like it gives a nice sound and complete algorithm, sound meaning it doesn't prematurely collect, and complete meaning it doesn't leak, I want to make sure that that it doesn't introduce excess tracing when you're tracing all of the roots of an actor, the roots meaning its fields and the things in its remembered set. Because what we don't want is a situation where 50 actors have reference to the same large immutable graph, and every single one of them traces that entire large immutable graph every time it does garbage collection. So that's what I'm working on. Was that helpful to people at all?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes, and actually describes some issues I've been having. I'm really happy to know about this now.
Ah, excellent. Good. We're using some memory growth that really totally shouldn't have been happening.
Yeah, because I've been working on transient data structures. So this has been, I was doing some benchmarks and I was just like, why is the memory exploding?
I apologize.
Oh, it explodes. Oh, man. When we found this, we were pumping hundreds of thousands of messages through Wallaroo. And yeah, wow, it exploded quickly on us.
Yeah. Yeah. So Sean can give you pointers on how to work around it for now, which mostly involves send it as a val as early as possible.
Yeah.
But I'll be hopefully, finally arriving at a true fix for this.
Actually, the correct thing to do is send it as an ISO.
Oh, always ISO.
Yeah.
Yeah, and never.
Don't take your ISO thing and send it as a val. Send it as an ISO, and then you sidestep the bug.
Wait, but how does this affect Tran?
I don't know. Never use it to send anything.
Because I'm using Tran.
But are you accumulating something that's Tran and then you're making it a val and sending it somewhere?
Yes.
Ah, okay. That's why. Same issue. Yeah. So I should rephrase that as you have a collection of things that were sent amongst actors with some level of mutability of any kind. And then when they were frozen as a val, we leaked.
That's what I figured.
And so by we, I mean,
is there a ticket
I
open for this already?
Yep, sorry.
Yes, there is. Okay. It's 8:37. It's been open since May 16th, 2016.
Been open since the year of our Lord, 837.
Right.
Do you think it will also fix the premature collection issue?
Premature collection?
Yeah, or maybe that was already fixed. I don't
remember. That we ran into a while ago.
Yes, I think I found the issue on the Bondesi repo, 1118. Okay.
Because I thought we had fixed all of our open premature collection issues. Looking. 1180.
No, 1180 is something different.
No, 1118.
1118.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, this one is still open. Yeah.
Yes, it will fix this issue.
Yes. Yeah, that's
absolutely, it will fix this issue.
Yep.
Okay. Good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, but as soon as I scroll down to the bottom, I'm like, oh look, there's my comment, right, because of the other one. Yes.
Yep. And my apologies, this is still ongoing.
Hard things are hard.
Hard things hard.
So, let's see, while we're here, like I said, an interesting topic of discussion for the next 10 minutes might be, or shorter, but, okay, so pull request 2043 is a pull request that I opened. We're probably not going to merge it as is, it has the do not merge still, but some interesting discussion has happened in the comments. Paul shared sort of like a mental model for that could potentially become a compiler model for, making sure that we're allowing like the maximum amount of things we can allow with a recover expression. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an interesting topic for discussion. And it relates to basically within the scope of a function, you would have origin tracking. While you're doing the checking for a function, you would do this origin tracking that would allow you to basically identify things that broke the isolated regions defined by recover expressions.
Origin here is referring to
It's evaluating the actual origins of each reference. To determine if there's a violation rather than, I would say that what we're using now is sort of like, I guess, general rules of thumb that the recover, evaluation knows, some things are unsafe because they violate this rule of thumb. But I think we're we're currently disallowing some things that are safe, and this is an interesting way of
looking. I would just like to point out that Paul has used one of my favorite comments from any paper ever, which is soundness is left as an exercise for the reader, and I'm very pleased.
So anyway, okay. the feedback I wanted to get about this is basically about, like, you know, one, does it sound right? And I think it probably does. And two would be, like, you know, I know that the advantage of using the kind of, like, rule of thumb is that, you know, way of evaluating things is that you don't have to know as much context to make a determination. Whereas
but
here you
have the advantage of having a compiler is that we have frame pointers and we can pass that context in. And actually, this is a perfect place to use a frame pointer.
Okay, so you think this is not an unreasonable burden to be using in the compiler, like a sort of, yeah, like another comb? I was worried about it being another one of those, like, combinatorial explosion issues, especially when you talk about wildcard origins.
That's okay, because a.create, the reason it's not so. So I guess I would just use a slightly different terminology than Paul in order to hopefully make it a little bit clearer, which is that rather than referring it to as an origin, because it's really just the region. It's that A0 right. is in region 0. So because origin, sometimes then we would think, well, A0 is the origin for B in this case, right? As in reading fields from via an origin. So I would just refer to that as a nested region. So A0 is in region 1. Hey, that's great. Or so in the first example, sorry, when I say first, so A.create, rather than saying that has wildcard origin, I would say that it's implicitly region 1, because a constructor is introducing the object within that region. So, and that actually might be quite nice in terms of being able to use these region identifiers also for assigning to things outside the region. So for writing as well as for reading.
So let's see, I'm trying to figure out if that makes a semantic difference to talk about it being implicitly region 1 versus a wildcard region. Like, say, if you, well, no, I guess it doesn't, because anything would have to be sendable to be, okay. Never mind about that.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know. See, because A.create, in order to be able to be assignable to A.ref, needs to be ISO. I'm sorry, I just said to A.ref because I read the type instead of the darn name. Assignable to A0, which is an A.ref outside the scope.
Right.
In order to be assignable to it, it needs to be ISO. And so that when we go back and reread A0, we can treat reading A0 as an ISO origin.
Ah, see, right, now it can pass origin between regions because it's isolated.
Right. And so if we say, oh, look, it's region 1, but that's okay. Look, it's isolated. I'm allowed to take something isolated and assign it to a lesser region number, right? That this actually seems pretty cool. I like this model. I mean, his comment is important. Soundness is left as an exercise for the reader, right? This might not work. But at first blush, I like the model, and I think it fits in quite well with the compiler because we have our frame stack and we can say, oh, look, we're gonna bump our region number in the frame stack when we hit it, when we hit a recovery block. Boom, problem solved.
Okay. One other thing that I wanted to discuss a bit was I was starting to get into that RFC that I owe Sean about TCP, like, you know, type parameterized notification stuff. And, you know, we talked about in those comments that the compiler piece that's needed for that is to be able to, you know, for a type param reference, give a cap. But I think that's actually not true. If this kind of led me down the chase toward, back to George Steed's paper, about Well, it was about a lot of things, but included in it is a redefinition of viewpoint adaptation.
Right, to have both the read adaptation and the extract adaptation.
Right. So, but not only is that differentiation there, but actually the as he presented in earlier virtual user group presentation, the rules for even the existing viewpoint adaptation, he found in his paper that we could actually make them more lax than they currently are, like allow more. And so I was looking at that, and I think that's actually going to solve the RFC issue, because then I can actually use an ISO viewpoint on the ref. If it's head parameter of the ref, I can use an ISO viewpoint on the ref, and the result would be ISO.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what I'm getting at is, so we have these tables that George Steed compiled, that are basically truth tables for the these tables for viewpoint adaptation. What I'm wondering is, we have the extracting, we have the non-extracting. Without adding that distinction in, is it sound to go through and take the more restrictive, basically cell by cell in those tables, go through, take the more restrictive one from the combination of tables, and apply that to our current viewpoint adaptation?
I think so. I suspect it might be worth, it might not be that much harder to actually add in the distinction between extracting and non-extracting.
But then we need syntax for it and RFC.
We don't need syntax at all. Because the extracting happens on assignment, and the non-extracting happens when there isn't assignment. That's the entire difference.
Right, but when you're specifying a type, if you say this method returns, something arrow something.
Yeah. Okay.
You want to be able to specify the extracting something, right?
No, not necessarily. Because as long as you're a subtype of the thing, then you would get away with this. I'm not even sure we would need additional syntax. We might, but off the top of my head, I can't think of a place where we would need additional syntax.
Well, I mean,
if you correctly did the extraction out of the ISO, then you wouldn't need to say as it's seen after extracting from an ISO, because once you've extracted it, you're done. You've got the thing itself, so you no longer need to say that.
But you need it in the return value, right, for a generic, not the return value, the return type in the method signature for a generic method.
I think only if you were passed in some A and you were extracting a field from that A and you needed to return an A arrow B where you had a quite unknown reference capability for A, maybe we'd get into some trouble. But even there, I'm not totally sure we would.
Okay. Well,
but maybe. It's a good question. You know what? I think we should have a look at that. I think if we proceed on the idea that it is sound and we both have a look at it, yeah, let's go for it. I would really love to get all of that
from the two tables, you mean? Like my idea about not introducing the distinction between extracting and not extracting yet, leaving that out for a future exercise, just taking the more restrictive from either table.
Yeah.
As our new table.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I almost wonder if it's going to be sound just to use the non-extracting, because that should theoretically always be weaker.
I was thinking the same, but I recall I looked at this a couple of weeks ago, so I'm a little bit fuzzy on it. But I think there were cases when it went both directions in terms of which.
Interesting. Okay, you know what?
Simple to see by looking at the paper.
And as you're running through it, email me any anytime you run on into anything that looks a little funny, because I would love to work with you on this.
Okay. Yeah. What I'll probably do is I'll open up a branch, and like a do not merge PR, and then we can just talk about it that way.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Alrighty. Are we at the end?
One more quick announcement. Lambda and array inference is coming very soon. I only have a few more edge cases to work through. So.
Sweet. That's awesome.
This is like my pony holy grail, actually. So I'm excited about it.
That is completely cool.
I'm excited.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming then. See you next week. Have a good one.